Wow, Jamie, it's great to have you on and to talk about your new book. When it first came out, I said to Rich, I said, you know, this book is a book I've been waiting for someone to write for a long time. And if I were more of a scholar, I would have given a stab at it myself, but I never would have done as well. I know you've been writing about this for a long time, and you're very invested in the hockey myth and Canadian culture and all that. But why did you decide to sort of go chronologically from Glengarry school days to Indian Horse?
Well, I wanted to show the evolution of ideas about the game. I also wanted to do it in chapters that allowed me to give in-depth treatment to some of the key texts, because it seemed to me that there had been such great scholarship previously, but people hadn't had the space to really look at them as literary works. So I was kind of doing those two things at the same time.
And that's the strength of the book for me, is that you're looking at the literary, I mean, which often in essays and stuff about hockey and Canadian culture and its role on that gets left out. They'll say this happened in this book. I thought what you did a great job in doing was showing how each author had a different style. I mean, I would never have read Two Solitudes if I hadn't known that it was important, and I'm really glad I did. It's a slog at times. I'm really glad I did.
Yeah.
But I began to see the way that the myth endures as the myth, and the way the myth doesn't endure as the myth. And I thought that
Yeah.
your way of delineating that was really good. When did you sort of think that was going to be one of the key parts?
Well, I think that it's impossible to talk about the early books without talking about this constellation of ideas around about the game that sort of came together in the early decades. And so, in a way, that becomes our reference point for the later works so often. It's like, these ideas came together about the nature of the game, and now people are responding to that, either taking from those early ideas things that are persisting, or they're challenging them in some way, showing what they're missing, especially the historical elements that they're leaving out with that conception. So I knew very early on that I would have to do that, but I didn't want to make it about just about the myth. It seemed to me that that was kind of a little too narrow, because what I wanted to do, I knew early on what I wanted to stress was that sport has imaginative possibilities in it that make the meaning of games, make the meaning of the sports always exceed the sort of simplistic models that people create. And we all do this, but that they're living things like works of art. They are transformed through times as each new generation reinvents them. And so I wanted to be able to say that about the game. So I didn't want to just stress on the myth, which is kind of ahistorical and a kind of a single thing,
How important, and you write about it so well, how important were the Scott Young books in establishing that ideal for young people?
Yeah, I think they were tremendously important. And they were popular, those books. It endured, in Jason Blake's book, which came out like 2010, something like that. He says that they're still the most popular books about hockey around. So those ideas were very influential, and it led to, of course, Young's publishers, probably with Young's okay, late in his life, they tried to update the books. I don't know if you've read the updated 1990s versions of the novels.
Oh, Scrubs, I did. It was awful.
It's painful because the ideas in the books are so rooted in the 1950s that you can't just change, Gordie Howe to Wayne Gretzky as the reference and then make the book make sense. It just didn't make sense. But that was testament to how enduring the conception was. And I was thinking about that too, that like you don't want to. I don't think it's right to just be sort of ironical about those persisting ideas about sport. I think you need to understand why they persist. Like, what are they still speaking to in people, and what people project upon sport and what they get back from sport. And the Scott Young books have this beautiful portrait of a boy, Bill Spunska. He's a natural athlete, but he's never played hockey before because he comes from Poland. And with his determination and the support of his teammates, he becomes the one player from that group who's likely to have a professional career, even more than the original protagonist. The first hero is the Canadian kid who's got it all, but it's Bill who is the one who's going to go on. And I think that's a wonderful story still. Like, I think it's still inspirational.
One of the things that I found interesting with that book is I teach boy on defense in my hockey lit class,
Oh
and
yeah.
I often ask the hockey players, male or female, that are in the class. I go, "When you were a kid, would this book have appealed to you?" And they all go, "Oh yeah, I mean this is the story I want." And then they'll all say, "Of course, nobody in the world gets that good in 18 months. There's no way. You could skate 24 hours a day with the best trainer. You'd never get that good. You'd never develop the good shot." And so it reminded me of books, I read as a kid that made me want to play a certain game or look up to a certain game. And then as I was a little older, I said, maybe not so. But what I think is interesting, and runs a theme that runs through your book, is that there's no point to tear that part of the myth down. There's
No.
no point to that because it's part of the history of the literature.
Yeah, it's part of the history of the literature, and it's also why we love sports in the contemporary. We want to, I love hearing the stories of athletes who come from backgrounds that are, like Bill's and who've, made it. Like, I loved when Jonathan Chichu was playing with Joe Thornton in San Jose. I love that story of the kid from the far north who, played in the indigenous community and then became this guy. And then, I think that's part of what attracts us to the games is those kinds of stories.
We're talking with
Well, you
Jamie
also
Dock
pointed.
about Hockey on
Go
the
ahead. I'm
Moon.
sorry, Rich.
Yeah, talking with Jamie about Hockey on the Moon, Imagination, and Canada's Game. And Jamie, I lean on you to help me fill the gaps in my knowledge as well. And after reading chapter 11 of your book, I need to get out and get a copy of The Good Body. That just sounds like such a fascinating piece of work.
And I think from a literary point of view, it's right up there as amongst the best of the literary works. And of course, Gaston actually has written about hockey in various ways. He's got a great book on playing old timers. And he himself played varsity for University of British Columbia. And he has a couple of funny stories about going to China on a goodwill tour with his university team. And I think he's channeling all that knowledge in The Good Body, and mixing it with his own sort of he's Buddhist. Let's call it what it is, right? His Buddhist spirituality. And he makes the great point that when players get in what we call the zone or the flow, they're achieving a state of consciousness that is not unlike what a Buddhist meditator is trying to achieve, union of body and mind, sense of the goodness and the order of things, but also the ability to do things without trying, in a sense. I mean, so much of that philosophy is about aiming with a capital A and not aiming with a small A, like in the archery books, or again, there's a real overlap there between sport and that kind of spirituality, it seems to me. And he gets that in that book.
And I think one of the fabulous things about The Good Body that is the way that, I mean, I've re because I've t teach it, fairly often. I've read it, I don't know, five, six times, is there's a fear in that book that runs underneath the surface all the way through it. And as someone who studied Eastern religions in college, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, what if I'm zenning out here, I'm saying this too shall pass, this too shall pass. And it seems that Bobby Bonaduce tries to do that. I mean, he resists all the help that he can get, but it's as if he's trying to will away all of that. And that is so much the story of so many athletes in so many sports.
Yeah, I agreed. And there's a, I think Gaston makes a really nice point there about how the tendency we have with our injuries, and this is as athletes, to just walk it off.
Yeah.
Right? And to try to just ignore what our body is signaling to us, that that is very much like the, you know, the spiritual injuries that people receive with a, in a culture that doesn't support the kinds of deeper sense of purpose that we would like as human beings, right? People just try to power on. And what Bonaduce has to do is he has to kind of reach the limit of that, trying to avoid confronting the significance of his body decaying at the end of his career. And he has to crash literally and physically in order to reach that moment where he can go, no, actually being human is also recognizing this frailty and living in the moment of my body. So I think it's a very profound intertwining of those two ideas.
It talks of intertwining all throughout your book. And I was one of the guys. I went to private school. We had an outdoor rink and we had to flood it late at night. And I get, you know, so the whole moon image and everything was going through was resonating with me. But was also being a New Englander and being a Franco, you know, my original name, family name is Plour, not Pratt. And we have that hat, no longer seems to me have that same tension between the two cultures. But what I hear is right along the border still in the St. John Valley, there is still some of that going back and forth. And I hadn't really thought about it because I'd never experienced it as a player, you know, playing hockey in prep school and college. I never heard any of that. But the fact that you investigated the way all these cultures, and I think about the indigenous player Brady Keeper, who played at Maine, is from a reserve way up north in Manitoba, I think. Where's Cross Lake? Anyway, where that should know better. And that so much of that story is only available to people that read these books because it's not really available other places. And that's why I loved the books that you chose.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, the changing relationship between hockey and the English-French conflict, that's a really interesting topic. And Ken Dryden helped to write, you know, the introduction to Rick Salutin's Les Canadiens. And he tells the story of how the Canadians were playing in the Forum on the night in 1976 when the Parti Québécois won the election. And the fans, who were supposedly these diehard fans investing all their national aspirations in the Montreal Canadiens, they didn't care about the game. They were all watching the scoreboard for the election results. And when the election results came in, they started cheering the Parti Québécois' victory. And for Dryden and for Salutin later on, what that showed them was that this idea that hockey was, you know, this banner for nationalism was fueled by the sense that the Québécois, that they didn't have political options. Right, they couldn't actually better their lives through that process. And then when the Parti Québécois came along, they thought, "Oh, wait a minute! Actually, no, we can channel our aspirations here." So, and I think now, you know, the Montreal Canadiens are still deeply invested in emotionally in Montreal and in Quebec, but I don't think it carries quite that weight of national aspiration as it did. And of course, the other thing that happened was that as the you know, the league evolved and they stopped having the 50-mile exclusion area where the teams would have exclusive rights to players who were born in those areas. The makeup of the Montreal Canadiens changed and they started getting many players that the fans loved who were not Québécois. And so then again, it became the team meant something different.
And you Bruce, you alluded to it, but I just wanted to mention how much I loved in the introduction, Jamie, your explanation of the title.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, that was a key moment for me. I was looking for, being a writer, you know, you look for an image that's going to hold things. And I was looking for an image that could be an image to hold such a big meditation on imagination and the game. And then I remembered making the backyard rink and how I always used to fantasize that my ice was the surface of the moon. And then and that was like an image for me about how powerful imagination is, but how it takes us into surprising places. And again, that was part of the theme I wanted to develop in understanding these representations of hockey, is that it's not predictable. The game changes as it's reimagined by people. So yeah.
Well, and you also did a great thing with that. There are rinks being built all across Quebec, northern Maine, the northern tier of the U.S., parts of Canada, because we don't have the winters that we used to have. And a lot of kids are growing up having never played on a pond, having never played on an outdoor rink. And there were those of us who didn't play on indoor rinks until I was in my teens, right? And I think that that part of the imagination was that for me, was that hockey was something you could do a lot of places. It could be a pond, it could be a frozen river, it could be a lake, it could be a backyard rink that somebody made. And when you're out there, it's a whole different feeling than skating in a rink. And I skate at the Alphonse Arena pretty regularly. Well, I did before they started the new construction. I love it, but it's not the same. And when you drew that through Chandail du Hockey, a hockey sweater, and into other stories, I hadn't seen that, and that, I hadn't made those connections. It was a real eye opener for me.
Yeah, I mean, even the sound of skating is different on outdoor ice. You can hear it. You can hear the ice is different. And there's imperfections in the ice that make the game different too. You know, you think of like how did people like Gretzky how could they handle the puck so well in bad conditions? Because you know they would still be dominant players when it was springtime and the arenas were getting crappy. Well, probably part of it was learning to play a lot on outdoor ice where the puck would bounce and there'd be stuff you'd have to you know, charge of. Kind of like baseball players who grow up playing on sandlots, you know, and have to learn to react to all the accidental deflections of the ball off the imperfections of the ground, right? They have to develop a certain kind of reaction that's a bit different. I'm sure, I mean, the players today are so well trained that they all have these great hand-eye things, but I do think the natural ice had a had a, an effect. But also, if you think about the meanings in the game, there is still something we want, I think, in hockey that connects back to the natural landscape. Again, a bit like baseball, you know, the baseball as the taking you back to small town America and that sense of connection to the land. I think hockey has that role in northern climates.
You know, it's funny you mention that because in skiing, one of the things that they always talked about was how, for a long time, when you just didn't have all these water-infused things and all the stuff they have in World Cup level skiing now, the skiers from the East were dominant because they skied on more kinds of snow than skiers in the West, and it was really only about 30 years ago that that paradigm really shifted. And it was who could ski the most days and who had the most training, because every single slope that they practiced on had been groomed and packed and done a certain way. Another thing you really, I thought, identified in a way no one has done before was the role of the priest in the hockey sweater. I mean, I had, when I saw that and then I thought of Indian Horse, I went, oh, wow. Where did this priest come from? Why is he out there refereeing a hockey game with a bunch of young boys who could referee it themselves just as well? That really struck me.
Well, I mean, all the history that has been revealed since the hockey sweater was published makes that image so sinister.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
So sinister.
what is he doing refereeing a pickup game between 9-year-olds? You know, it's like, whoa. And actually, interestingly, in Carrier's book about the Rocket, he points out that the rink that he's imagining in that story was actually the second rink in his hometown, because there was an original outdoor rink, and the priests thought it was so immoral that, you know, boys and girls might end up skating on the rink together. And who knows, some of them might actually hold hands and things. So the priests actually shut down the rink because of the fear of moral taint, from the rink. So that shows you how powerful that presence was. And so this is actually the second rink in his hometown he's imagining. And the priest is right there still, policing it all. Yeah, it's very, very powerful.
One of the other things that I really admired about the book was the way that each chapter, so often books that are in some kind of chronological way are less interesting than sort of, narratives that move all over the place. But that each time you went to a new place, the thread went all the way back to Glengarry in some way. And I thought what was really good about that, and why I intend to use it as a text in the future, is that it allows the person who's teaching the class to say, okay, here's what I was my take on this. You should read this because this will take you on a through course. And there are very, very rarely books in sports lit, in my experience, that do that. And so I thought that was really something else.
Well, thank you very much. And I loved writing that chapter. Ralph Connor is so fascinating as a figure. And that's a really good example of how you have to not just be ironical about these historical representations, because Ralph Connor, muscular Christianity, these ideas are now seem pretty dated in the 21st century. But he was a very admirable person, in his 50s. He was the chaplain for the Canadian 3rd Division that went to France. So he went to the front lines in France in his 50s to be chaplain to the troops. Like, that's how principled this guy was. And so you can kind of laugh at some of the datedness about that conception of the game in that book, but I still deeply respect Connor and as a person, but also there's a lot in that book still that resonates with me. But some of it is like totally hilariously funny, and like the whole making the game, making men of the boys, but not only making them men, but making them muscular Christian men, so they're all going to go off to become Presbyterian ministers at the end of the big game. Like, that's like, wow. So some of that you have to laugh at. There's also the old-fashioned gender attitudes, and this is a theme through the book too, is how it took quite a while for hockey culture to begin to be more inclusive from a gender point of view, also from a racial point of view. And the early texts like Glengarry School Days illustrate how, though it's presented in a kind of benign way, it's still very much a masculinist world, isn't it?
And that's why I thought the discussion of 20 miles becomes so important, as a book, is our only book that's only novel written by a woman who played university level hockey herself, and one of the things that's fascinating about that book, again, with my students, is one year I asked the male players as what their favorite book we read all year. Rich will remember these names: Mark Anthoyne and Stu Higgins and Marty Ouellette and Will Merchant. Four of the five of them chose 20 Miles, and I said to them, "Well, why was it your favorite book?" And they said, "Because we discovered they're just like us." I thought that was I just and the girls who played hockey in the class were like clapping and yelling and saying, "Yes."
And the opening of that book is great for that, because Iz follows the team captain into the for the first practice, and she looks at her from behind, and she has the big ass of a hockey player. Right? And it's not that she's a woman with a self-conscious about her big butt, right? She's a hockey player. She's got huge glutes, and the triple-headed monster of the hockey heels of the hockey player, right? And so yeah, I could just see how the guys would go, yeah, exactly. She's
Well,
got
and
a
they
hockey
love
body.
the girls love the expression "building junk in the trunk."
Yeah,
You know, all
exactly.
the hockey, the female hockey players I had were going,
Yeah,
"Yeah, I gotta
exactly.
have junk in my trunk. Anybody got a problem with that?" I mean, they're it just that book really is great because it enlivens a lot of discussion. The Good Body is a little more serious in some ways, and you know, it's that's the true of the last season. You know, you've got those serious things. Not that there aren't serious moments in 20 Miles, but just I love the way that your book is going to allow me to sort of restructure my class now. It's going to be great.
Well, it was very important to me that there be a book written by a woman that concentrated on the women's game, because it is a big part of the history and it doesn't get much acknowledgement. So I think Kara Headley's book is very important. And it's a fun read. And the players, I love how the players are self-aware about the stereotypes, both of hockey players and of female athletes. And they kind of play with the stereotypes themselves self-consciously. You can see that Headley is, well, first of all, she's basing it on her experience of playing varsity, but also really portraying this culture as reimagining the game, put it that way, you know, from these types.